Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's Power of the Herd web symposium call. This is on Chapter 8, Herd Power. And of course, as ever, I'd like to welcome back Linda Kahanoff.
Thank you, Mark.
How are you doing after your holiday, or your vacation, should I say?
Oh, it was excellent. We went to the beach in San Diego. It was gorgeous weather, and I did nothing for 4 days.
Well, you deserve that, that's for sure. Can I just ask you just to move your mic down slightly, because we're getting a bit of
too much breathing.
A bit of heavy breathing going on, and it's a bit early in the evening for that.
I'm so excited.
Okay. All righty. Okay, so housekeeping, folks. As you know, if you'd like to ask a question, you're obviously on the chapter page now, and there should be a Q&A box there. So if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, then just type your question or comment in the box, and I shall try and feed it into the conversation. Yeah, you know the routine. We've done it before. Okie dokie. So let's get stuck into Chapter 8 then, Herd Power. So this kind of feels like you're now, after this kind of last chapter, you're really now starting to set out. And as you say, they kind of link together, but this is really going in the sort of almost, it seemed to me, like the beginning of the solutions phase of our journey. I found it really very interesting reading all about the Fulani herdsman. Is that how you pronounce it?
I believe so, Fulani.
And it seems like it's for Westerners, I would think, a very confusing community, because on the one hand, they live almost, you know, live in this sort of pastoral life in harmony with their animals. But on the other hand, it seems to be quite misunderstood from the studies that you talked about in the chapter there. And obviously there isn't, as you mentioned, not much mention of women. So I wonder sort of if you could just talk a little bit about how you came across this and how perhaps you reconcile the sort of lack of the fact that they don't talk about women much in these studies with the fact that this is supposed to be, you know, the pastoral, caring type of society. And, well, I'll ask you about the right to passage thing a bit later. So,
yes. Well, I think that the reason the Fulani are so interesting is because they're one of the last actual nomadic pastoral cultures around that is on foot with their animals. So it causes them to have to engage certain kinds of power and leadership in ways that are very interesting and very nuanced, and that I believe we can learn a lot from. I certainly wouldn't want to be a Fulani in this day and age. I like my life. I love the conveniences of modern civilization. But I do believe that if we can learn lessons from what they know about the nuances of power and leadership and how to use assertiveness and aggression, not how to be aggressive and not how to sublimate it either. I think these are key pieces. And the rite of passage that I talk about in this chapter, the Sharo, is it's a kind of a physically violent rite of passage, but most tribal male rites of passage have some element of pain or endurance involved. So they're right on line with that. But what I found was that turned out – are you still there, Mark?
Yeah.
Okay, I heard a snap, and I thought maybe I got cut off. It ends up being one of the key pieces, I realized, using the Sharo as a metaphor for building emotional heroism that we talked about earlier with George Washington. And so by the time we get to Guiding Principle 11, I actually use the Sharo as a model when you take it out of the realm of physical violence, where it becomes a very effective tool in exercising emotional heroism.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, in the studies, it seemed to be, or the initial study, I think, it seemed to be slightly, they took it as a sign that this was an aggressive society. But you seem to see it differently to that. And am I right then in assuming that because it works both ways, the one does it to the one, and then it's his turn the next day or the next year or whatever, then there's a certain amount of respect that's kind of generated through the process?
Well, the interesting thing about the Sharo is it appears to be a way of handling male aggression, adolescent male aggression challenges. You know, male horses do this. you know, predatory and non-predatory animals alike engage in adolescent forms of aggression and power plays and all of that. And this seems to be one of the most constructive ways of handling that. It's a little raw because it actually involves physical pain. But I believe that if we can transfer this to a psychological, metaphorical way of dealing with emotional attacks, verbal attacks, we can become very effective in this. And I talk about this extensively, as I say, in Guiding Principle 11. I really wish you could see it now, but I think there are a couple of other chapters you need for all of this to make sense. Because I talk about how I incorporated or learned some of these concepts with my stallion Merlin, who was abused, who would attack me for no reason. And I realized that over time, when I had a Charo-like stance with him, that it was the most constructive thing I could do. And as you'll see in Chapter 9, I talk about these encounters with Merlin, and it was really hard on me to realize that kindness and understanding could not transform that level of misused power. Merlin had been abused, and he was very aggressive. And so this was where, when I encountered the Fulani tribe while I was doing research for this book, and the way I found the Fulani tribe was reading Meg Daly Olmert's book about the human-animal bond, the biology of the human-animal bond, Made for Each Other is the name of that one. And she talks about the Fulani tribes in there. She's mostly making a case for the fact that their culture engages the oxytocin response through, you know, this mutual nurturing, and that it helps to create the glue that holds the tribe and the herd together. And that's true. But then when I started to do research into the actual more articles than she references in her book, I started to find that they really show you, if you're really paying attention, they show you the difference between assertiveness and aggression. And so in that article that Lott and Hart write about the Charo as an example of aggression in Fulani society, the point I think they're missing is that what they're really doing is socializing power, and they're actually showing that when someone challenges you, a valued option in their society is to not fight back. They don't really make this point so clearly. They just talk about it as an example of aggression. Well, I think what is much more aggressive is in our quote-unquote civilized culture, how we have the phenomenon of bullies bullying happens with the goal of winning at any expense, by underhanded means or whatever. And you have boys and now girls, too, engaging in bullying behavior. And it's usually, you know, in some back alley or behind the school where there's no one to watch over them. People gang up on each other. Several bullies will gang up on one weak child, that sort of thing. The Charo is much less aggressive than that. And I think that we don't own our own aggression in civilized cultures. And then we see an example like the Fulani Charo, where a young boy accepts a challenge and in public agrees to be whacked with a stick to show that he can handle the blows life is going to send him. And he can be present and he can avoid the flight or fight response in favor of the feeling of being in a vulnerable position and showing courage. And I just think that it was such a marvelous find for me. It turned everything around for me. It has made it so much easier for me to deal with challenges and sometimes even attacks, whether it's from an adolescent horse or an abused horse or an angry, crazy person or an angry, aggressive, sane person. Whatever happens, if I see that as an impromptu Charo, everything changes for me.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Well, there's just way too many questions to ask. Okay. I'm going to have to try and remember them then. Okay, so the first one is, it was kind of more of a comment. It seemed to me, and maybe, excuse me, I'm seeing it perhaps from a male standpoint. But as I mentioned just a couple of seconds ago, it seems to me that as it's a reciprocal thing, and when you say reciprocal in the chapter, you actually mean it's the same guy that they like, they're paired off and the one beats the one and then the one beats the other, or does it go around in circles, or I get to why I'm asking in a minute. Actually, it probably doesn't matter anyway.
Yeah, no, it does matter. That is part of the point, is that, you know, a young man will challenge another young man. And the one who accepts, you know, who's ever challenged is the one who stands there and takes the blows in this public place where everybody sees that he is accepting a challenge and he's refusing to fight back and he's showing incredible courage and endurance. And then the idea is that that one who was beaten that time then gets to challenge the challenger in the future, and he can do it the next day or he can do it the next year. And so this has a quality that's different than university fraternity hazing, where you have older members of a fraternity abusing the younger members. In this situation, it's equal. You know, if you challenge somebody, you are automatically saying you get to do the same thing to me later.
Right. And I just wonder, as I say, because I'm a man, I'm just wondering whether it doesn't also build in a certain amount of respect, not just for the guy who's getting it, but also that, and I'm not saying that, I'm probably, it's just a question, that if people doling out the beating, whether they in fact just, they respect the person for the other guy for standing up to it, but they also respect them to the point that they won't beat them to death. You know,
yeah.
They want to teach them a lesson, but there's a certain control required.
Yeah,
you know,
and it is.
Whereas, just to finish off my train
yeah,
of
sure.
thought, whereas when it gets into like a bullying situation or a physical situation, or you read about it on the, I don't know, you hear about it on the news where, you know, some older person gets beaten up by a young thief or whatever, there's no limit, there's no stopping, it just goes on until, you know, something nasty happens. And I'm just wondering whether in that moment of aggression there's a sense of self-restraint, and that itself is very powerful. That's again emotional heroism.
Yes, and I think that I mean, there are instances when I looked more deeply into the Sharo, where now and then somebody does actually die from the injuries. But
wow.
I don't think it's ever the intent. You know, I mean, children or young men die in fraternity hazing situations where they drink too much or they're, you know, engaging in some kind of risk-taking behavior. That happens also. But the intent is not for one person to kill the other so he doesn't have a chance to come back at him. I mean, because it's done in public, I would imagine that there is a certain point at which an authority figure would stop it. It is a dangerous thing to do. And so I really feel like the Sharo, when it's taken out of the realm of physical violence, is where it comes in handy. And when I talk about transforming the Sharo concept into an emotionally heroic context, we're going to add some social intelligence skills, too, so that the idea is that if somebody challenges you, you don't fight back and you don't engage in a reciprocal element of abuse. You're going to leave that part out and you're going to do something even more heroic, which is to have a difficult conversation with that person that's constructive and non-shaming. So I believe that the Sharo is a brilliant innovation from a tribal male aggression point of view, if it's taken out of the realm of physical violence. But it's fascinating, isn't it, that, you know, there are other rituals where, you know, people fight with each other and, you know, the goal is for some kind of person to win. And so there is no interest in taking the blows and standing up to a challenge and showing vulnerability. It's all about not showing vulnerability. And this was very interesting to me because it showed a person's willingness to be vulnerable and the fact that the society itself values accepting a challenge with courage without fighting back.
And is this ritual carried out before the whole tribe or just the men of the tribe?
It appears to happen during festivals where several tribes come together. So what you see are a number of tribes. It must be a rather large, and I think men and women actually view this. I don't know for sure, but that's the impression I get.
So that kind of implies that it's even more impressive because it's, in a way, because it's in front of peers and also strangers, you know. So, you know, the facing up to it becomes more rewarding in a way.
Yes. And I believe that's part of what keeps it from getting out of hand, too. It's not some back alley bullying. If you challenge somebody, everybody's going to watch how you're treating the person that you've challenged. And you must also be challenged as a result. Like I say, in terms of emotional heroism, we're going to leave out the ability to have the reciprocal challenge to go after the person who challenged you. We're going to do something else instead that also involves a certain amount of heroism. So.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just go back then and ask you about, you said when you faced up, you recognized when you were with Merlin, you were in a Sharo situation. sorry about that. What did that look like?
Well, because Merlin had been severely abused, and you'll read more about it in chapters 9 and 10, when I took him on, he would attack anybody. If you even tried to touch him, he acted like you shocked him with a cattle prod. And he would come and attack you for no apparent reason, constantly. This is a characteristic of certain kinds of abuse survivors also, human abuse survivors. And so what happened was I found over time that if I could hold my ground, in other words, I would have a whip with me, and if he came after me to attack me, I would use the whip to have him back off just enough to hold my space. But after that, if he even for one split second showed me any attempt to respect my space and to stop attacking me, I would immediately go to a place of immediate positive feedback with him while still holding my ground. And it was like, because I didn't run after with him with the whip and punish him, and because I didn't hold grudges as a result, I simply said, hey, I'm holding my safety space here. Once you back off, we're back to, you know, ground zero again, and we're going to move forward with our day. And because he had been abused by a person who not only beat him and punished him, but made him grovel in shame with his head tied between his legs in a darkened stall, The fact that he could attack me and I would hold my ground with power, but I would never punish him or fight back. I mean, I would never, like, attack him back. I would hold my ground, but that was it. He would just stop and he would look at me and you could just see the wheels turning in his head. And over time, the attacks became less and less frequent. And if he did, he would look like, oops, sorry, wow, I really slipped there, you know. And so it just transformed everything. And I hadn't read about the Sharo at that point. But it was really, really, really scary to be in there with that horse when he was like that. He would almost look like he had multiple personality disorder or something, because even the pupils of his eyes would change. I realized after a while that I could tell that he was going to attack right before he would, because his expression would change and in his the pupils of his eyes would narrow. And you could just see that he had tripped a switch and he was a different horse. And this technique worked with him beautifully over time.
Yeah, and so I guess it was a case of the fact that it was almost building trust. He knew that come what may, whatever you threw at him, on the one hand, you weren't going to cower and whimper or run away, or, you know, and therefore he had his day. But on the other hand, you weren't going to attack him and beat him and punish him. So you therefore built in this sort of, you know, in my humble estimation, this sort of mutual respect then. And he said, okay, well, you know, good for her kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Kristin is written in and she's saying, this is kind of related. My two-year-old mare, normally willing to be handled, reared up and struck at me recently. This is only about learning respect for the two-year-old. Is that how you saw it? It surprised me and disturbed me. I wasn't prepared for that from her. So, of course, we don't know the history of the two of them, and it sounds like this is the first-time occurrence.
It's very typical for young horses to do that. They do it with each other. So you really don't want to take it personally. I mean, it's possible that that she was showing signs of stress and you were pressuring her, and finally, because you didn't notice that you were pushing her a little too hard with something new, perhaps, that may have seemed minor to you, but, you know, caused her blood pressure to rise and her tension to rise. Her only way to finally say, look, this is too much for me, is to rear up and kick out. That's inappropriate behavior. I mean, it may be, it's like the idea that we're going to read misbehavior as a form of communication. So in the future, what you want to do is make sure that you're noticing signs of rising tension in your young horse, and then actually back off before she has to get to that place. But also show her that if she gets to that place, that you hold your ground, you back her off, and then when she calms down, you breathe and you give her immediate positive feedback in the form of, all right, we're moving forward with our day. There is, I'm not like taking off points on you, or I'm not going to hold a grudge, or I'm not going to shame you later and punish you. You know, this is inappropriate. Now you're relaxed. Now let's move forward with our day.
Right. Okay, so let's just translate that whole scenario to a human-to-human situation then. How do you deal with that in that sort of scenario? You were giving various examples just a few moments ago about different types of people or that you might come across or different situations. How do you how would you handle that?
So I outlined this very specifically in Guiding Principle 11, but I think it's appropriate to talk about it now also. A lot of times people will attack you based on something small that you've done in the present that reminds them of something in the past that was, you know, hurtful to them in some way. So maybe about 10% of a strong reaction is about something you did with that person that was offensive to them, let's say. And about 90% has to do with 50 other people that did something similar in the past, or a really abusive parent of some kind. So when somebody suddenly attacks you, what you want to do, and we're talking about a verbal attack here. If somebody attacks you physically, you have to like leave the room immediately and call the police. There's never any excuse for physical violence in modern interpersonal context, okay? But if somebody attacks you verbally, whether it's in public or not, you're going to just immediately think of this, oh, this is an impromptu sharo. I'm going to not fight back. However, I'm going to stay present. I'm not going to show weakness. I'm going to hold my ground. And what I'm going to do instead is listen to what this person's saying, kind of taking notes as they're attacking me, you know, maybe calling me a bunch of names, or maybe telling me I'm a loser, or I did this or that or whatever. And I'm going to notice, I'm going to start to differentiate between what I may have actually done that tripped them off, and then recognizing also from what they're saying that they are talking about other things in the past probably. And in not fighting back, what happens a lot of times if you just stand there and breathe and then even start to ask questions like, okay, so when you say I've deeply disappointed you, what exactly were you expecting for me to do? I'd really like to know what your expectations are so that in the future, you know, I don't disappoint you. Or if I've overstepped a boundary with you and offended you, please let me know exactly what that is, and let's talk about some behavior of the future that we can do differently. You may not be able to say anything at that moment if the attack is really extreme. When somebody goes off on you and just starts like berating you, the best thing you can do is just stand there and breathe, and then later come back and engage what I call the difficult conversation, which is Guiding Principle 9. And I'll go ahead and post Guiding Principle 9 when we post Chapter 9, so you'll have that information. And that's in itself a kind of heroic act, but it's a thoughtful, emotionally and socially intelligent heroic act. So basically, if somebody starts attacking me, I'm not going to attack them back. If somebody starts shaming me, I'm not going to shame them back. I'm just going to take it. And then I'm going to take notes on what they're saying and recognize that it's obviously not all about me. But at the same time, there is something that I did to trip this person off. You know, maybe it's a blind spot in me. Maybe I need to go to a counselor or a coach and sort out what this person said and what may be my part in this. But no matter how shaming, no matter how mean-spirited, no matter how much this person tries to attack me and hurt me, I will not give them the same thing in response.
Yeah, it's that emotional heroism again. You know, it obviously just keeps cropping up again and again, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I suspect with some people, just that sort of not doing anything or breathing or, you know, just being there and being present is going to drive them even crazier. I guess they'll just blow themselves out at some point, will they?
Well, it actually doesn't drive them crazy, in my experience, as long as you don't stand there and give them this cynical look like you've really lost it, you're a total loser. You have to, like, avoid any kind of body language that looks like you're holier than thou, you know. So you really breathe and you sincerely listen to what they're saying. And what I've noticed more often than not is that when you do that, they might get upset for a couple of minutes. But they start to calm down and they start to feel like they're being heard. And because you're not engaging shaming behavior back at them, in other words, looking around at everybody else and rolling your eyes and just kind of pointing like, oh, well, there they go again, this crazy person. That actually more often than not calms a person down rather than aggravates them.
Yeah, ultimately they will subside, in other words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not about playing the victim. It's a position of power. It's saying, I can take it, and I'm going to turn this into something productive. It's a position of power. It's not saying, yes, beat me because I'm bad and, you know, I'm a loser. It's not like that.
I guess it's almost like a, if you are in that situation, then you can almost, I remember, I'll give you an example. I had laser surgery on my eyes about 10 years ago. And it was pretty scary because it's lasers in your eyes, right? And I remember saying, as it was happening, I remember saying, you know, my friend's the red light, my friend the red light. I was kind of saying this mantra to myself over and over again just to kind of get through it because it was very unpleasant. And it's almost like that. It's almost if you were to keep saying, you know, I'm going to make something good of this, and I will be listening to you, and you know, we'll find a better way through this. You know, to me, that's the kind of thing I'd be saying, because otherwise, my head and my feelings are going to be filled with wanting to attack back and revenge and so forth. And I guess once one masters this emotional heroism, then it'll comes easier. But to begin with, I imagine it's terribly difficult.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it doesn't happen to me as often anymore, but I'm often in rooms of people where it starts to happen between several people. And so I'm modulating that as well. And just by breathing and asking questions of both parties in a similar way, I can turn it around a little bit. But it really helps if, like with all my apprentices now and with all the people I teach in the leadership program, I literally teach how to do this with a very specific procedure so that they understand, you know, that we're going to back them up if this happens and we're going to help modulate this. But you know that you're going to, you know, so that I can even say, look, this is an impromptu Sharo situation and everybody's going to know all of a sudden. And they kind of sit up straighter and they actually – because if both people in an altercation know that this is a possibility, then they seem to calm each other down as a result. And then hardly ever can you have a really productive conversation when it's a Sharo situation. It's like you're being attacked, and all you can do is kind of hold your ground and maybe take notes and ask a few questions. But you can't really do the constructive work then because emotionally you're wounded. It's like a young man in the Sharo physical violent situation where he's being beaten with a stick, you know. The next day, he's not coming back so easily. He's got to go and heal from it. And so when you get attacked verbally by somebody,
it's going to take some practice, folks.
It hurts. And you have to realize, I'm hurt, I'm wounded, I didn't fight back, so I achieved that. But now it's time for me to have some quiet time. It's time for me to go with my best friends and my spouse and any support system I have and heal and then go back and deal with a more constructive option later once you get gotten more stabilized and supported. So it never stops hurting. I probably feel more now the pain than I used to because I'm willing to be present for the situation. So it hurts. It never stops hurting.
But the wounds heal, though.
They do, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I mentioned at the beginning about the fact that the studies that you quote in the chapter don't really talk much about women. And I say one of my questions was really how you, as you obviously have a slightly different take on the studies than they showed, how you kind of reconcile women's place within the Fulani culture compared to the sort of the studies and what they showed.
Well, I had a hard time finding any discussion of Fulani women except in the work by the guy I quote at the end, this Reisman, Paul Reisman. And he's a man looking at Fulani life. He's written a pretty extensive book called Freedom in Fulani Social Life or something like that. I have it somewhere written down. You can read that book, and there are some discussions of the life of women because he lived with the tribe with his own wife, and I think his own wife was able to get in on some level. But he's still it's just – especially since this material came out in the 1970s, think about it. In the 1970s, in our culture, not a whole lot of studies were being done about women. You know, it took women researchers in our own scientific community to start to really get a handle on what women's issues were. So I just think that it's really hard until we get a woman researcher to go and live with a Fulani tribe as a woman. And talking to the women, I don't see how we're really going to know much about what the women experience.
Okay, so we don't know. So can you surmise?
I wouldn't dare. No. I don't know what their experience is. The only things I've been able to find out is that generally the women stay in the camp and the men go out with the cattle during the day. And that the women are often the ones who are doing the milking and the creating of you know, cheese and other types of food from the milk products. These are just the simple details of what you see. They give you surface details about Fulani life and what they see the women doing, but they don't tell you what the women's emotional experience is or how women deal with power and conflict among each other. They never touch on that. I haven't been able to find that.
But from an overview, it doesn't really sound like something very different or something that you wouldn't expect anyway. You know, the little woman stays at home and milks the cow. See what I mean?
I think in a lot of tribal cultures, you find that the woman's life is related to children and the home because literally they're getting pregnant all the time and they're constantly having babies and they're constantly breastfeeding. And there's just not, you know, this is why I really wouldn't want to be a conventional tribal woman. I just would rather lead a life that where I have more options. They don't really have birth control. And, you know, it's worse in Fulani tribes that are more fundamentalistically Muslim. The Fulani didn't start out by being Muslims, but after a while they were converted because that was the dominant religion of the era. And then what you find, I know for sure, is that Fulani that now become sedentary and go into the cities are more influenced by traditional notions about women being powerless. So there is some suggestion that the pastoral cultures who are still nomadic, the women have more freedom and power than any traditional culture that then becomes sedentary.
Yeah. Let's talk a little now about the relationship then within the with the men have with the cows, because obviously that's, you know, that's as extraordinary as the rite of passage that we heard about in its way.
Yeah,
and it kind of reminds me of in Carolyn Resnick's book, if you've read it, where she grew up in the desert in after the war sometime, and they didn't have any fences either.
Right, so, I have read Carolyn's book.
Yeah, so the horses, you know, they had to, obviously the horses had a vested interest in staying close to the town, because that's where they could get their food and water, because it was in the desert. But even so, it still was a totally different challenge because of the lack of fences on both sides. But this sounds like even more extreme, because they, you know, in the dry season, they're grazing or trying to graze on what's left of the grass right next to fields of corn or whatever it is.
Yeah, so I think they have to engage real, authentic power rather than power related to restraint, technological power in terms of fences and restraints. And so their only option really is to socialize the cattle as a part of their tribe. And I just thought that was so fascinating, because these animals are socialized along with the tribe from the day they're born. So it's not like they pull a cow off the range and then break them, you know, like in a conventional cowboy way. They live with the tribe daily, and the cows and the bulls are taken out during the day to graze, and the calves stay in the camp. That's part of how they socialize them. It probably is also how they protect them from predators. So they probably keep the young cattle in the camps, partly as a way of protecting them from predators, but it also has a socializing effect, because, you know, in our culture with horses, we tend to rip them away from their parents and wean them suddenly at the age of 6 months usually, and they never see their parents again. And I believe that most horses have what we would call in human attachment disorder as a result. And a lot of this really flighty behavior you see in horses doesn't happen with horses who've allowed to be weaned slowly from their parents and then be put back in with their parents and live with their herd in a different way, socialized in a different way. So I have a lot of horses that I raise that way. And what I've seen is everybody comes and says, I've never seen such a secure two-year-old before. These horses don't have flight responses that you would see, that you normally associate with horses, because they feel like they're safe. They're with their parents, and their human attendants are like aunts and uncles. Same thing with these cattle. So the cows and the bulls go out to graze during the day. The calves stay in the camp with the boys and the girls and the older men and women and the women. And then the cows and bulls come back at night. So they begin to see and respect the humans and look to them for guidance in the same way that they would another cow. And so it's a socialization process that starts from birth, which is then why they have such an incredible leadership ability out in the unfenced country.
Right. So they're used to being around the humans, and obviously there must be a degree also of minding what they're doing, because, you know, there are certain places in the camp that they don't want them to go. And do the younger boys, for example, kind of do training on the younger cows? I mean, not necessarily active. Well, yeah, perhaps actively.
Yes, they actually specify that in the articles where they've studied this, is that boys probably from the age of six, they start out by giving these boys the task of pulling the calves away from the cows. And then what they do is, while the cows are leaving the camp, they tie them up to a rope. They tie the calves up to a rope to keep them away from the cows until the cows get beyond, sight or smell range, I guess. And then they let them loose and let them mill around the camp.
Sorry about that. I tried to mute myself before I sneezed, but it was too late.
Okay, bless you.
Apologies.
I thought the world was coming to an end.
It does sometimes when I sneeze. I was desperately trying to find the mute button on the control panel, and it was too late.
Well, and you know, the other thing too is that there's quite a case. This is the case that Meg Daly-Olmert made, is that with the men, you know, helping to birth the cattle and, you know, men and women milking the cattle and everybody spending a large amounts of time rubbing the cattle and grooming the cattle, petting the cattle, that there's an oxytocin response that's released, which creates a bonding effect. So it's partly behavioral, it's partly socialization, but then according to this new oxytocin theory, it's absolutely profoundly reinforced and facilitated by this hormone designed to calm and connect everybody.
And I was particularly intrigued by this, the fact that the men also do this. They rub the cows on the inside of the leg. Is that some sort of, I don't know, specific spot for cows? Does it work with horses too? And is it related feeding when they're young?
Well, it's a spot that on the inside of the back leg. Is when a calf is nursing, a cow will generally rub and lick her baby in that spot. It just happens to be a convenient spot, I guess, while your calf is nursing. But then everybody, as they get older, if you're a cow, they associate that with this nurturing feeling, and it probably also brings back memories of being able to nurse. And so adult cattle don't really do this with each other. They only do it with their young. But by the men of the tribe who are the leaders and the dominators of the tribe, or of the herd, by them doing this, they're also putting themselves in the role of the parent and nurturer on a daily basis. They're reminding them that they also play that role, is the theory behind it.
Mm, mm. Yeah, well, it's also very effective.
Yeah. So what I love about this Fulani lifestyle, at least as much as we can find out, is that what you see is this, it's almost like you want to talk about relationship off lead or relationship beyond fences, community beyond fences. The idea is that a master herder needs to play the role of the leader and also the dominant, which in non-predatory animals, the leader and the dominant are often two different animals, as I discuss in this chapter.
Mm.
And they really give you a great, you really get to see the difference between the leader and the dominant animal in this. And you learn how, when I'm going to be dominant and for what purposes that are constructive and when I'm going to lead and what that looks like. And then also you recognize that you can't just be the leader and the dominant. You also have to be the nurturer and companion, which is what continues to reinforce that oxytocin bonding loop. And then also, because you're a human, you are also engaging this inner predator aspect. The inner predator aspect, or your inner lion or tiger, I argue in this chapter, you don't really need much of that, actually, if you have the other things working for you. So that at one point I say you just need a drop of a tiger, you know, to protect your herd from carnivores and more likely excessively predatory members of your own species. But even that, it's very rare, because what you see is in large prey animals, they're courageous, they're altruistic, they will rescue weaker herd members at the possible expense of their own life. And that they're fully capable of standing up to a lion. And in Guiding Principle 8, I give an actual very graphic example of how profoundly large herd animals will act powerfully and altruistically to save a single vulnerable herd member from an entire pride of lions. I mean, we've been taught that prey animals are weak and scared. But they're not if they're raised and socialized properly. They're brave and they're courageous and they can stand up to lions. And so as human beings, we don't need to have carnivorous predatory metaphors for power anymore. We can have non-predatory power now that's highly effective.
Yeah, and so it is this sort of new kind of power and strength without being, as you say, predatory and sort of overwhelming. There's a question that Kristin has asked about. It's kind of sort of slightly related to this, and it's related to, I think, what's the guy at the name of the end of the chapter? Is it Reisman?
I think you pronounce it Reisman, or maybe it's Reisman. I'm not sure.
If it's if you're in Germany, you pronounce it Reisman.
Okay, well, it must be Reisman, yeah.
So I can say that. She was saying, regarding the experience of deep intimacy, the researcher experienced with the Fulani, would love to hear Linda speak more about experiencing intimacy with her horses in ways that are different than humans typically experience.
Well, I didn't...
Is there a translation there, as it were?
Yeah, there is. One of the things that I didn't get to write about in this book because I simply ran out of space is that I realized that by socializing, in my attempt to socialize Merlin, I actually instinctually drew upon what turned out to be this bizarre development of a herd that brought all of those elements together and actually invigorated the oxytocin response, as well as the bravery of what it took to stand up to a stallion that challenging. Because when Merlin was able to mate with my mare Rasa, they actually had twins prematurely. We didn't even know Rasa was pregnant. She kept losing her foals, and then she ended up being pregnant with twins, and we didn't catch it in time. And to, you know, usually you abort one to save the other. But so she had these twins that are, one of them was stillborn, and the other one, he was so premature he couldn't even stand up. He would have died in nature. There's just no question about it. And so we had to milk Rasa and feed Spirit. And through the act of milking Rasa and feeding Spirit with a bottle and taking care of Spirit like an actual cross between a human and horse child, I realized that we had engaged in a lot of the same socialization processes that perhaps the Fulani have made a part of their culture. And what was interesting was that I had to have this constant combination of extreme bravery and also this open-hearted, huge, loving presence. I think my experience with Merlin and Rasa and Spirit caused me to look at this research about the Fulani and even be able to recognize the things that I pull out because it came from experience. The interesting thing was that, for instance, this calm and connect effect, I had a profound experience of it because when Spirit was born and we were having to milk Rasa and feed Spirit with the bottle, it also caused me to go into this altered state. And several other people who helped take care of Spirit said the same thing. And this was before we had read about oxytocin and this calm and connect effect. But you would just feel this intense connection to everything. And it's like, this effervescent sense of love in the room. And it was transformational for people who would come in and help, you know, milk Rasa and feed this horse. And you would feel this mystical sense of connection with all life. And at the same time, you would feel extremely brave and committed. It was a really odd combination. So that one night we had this thunderstorm and I was there staying with this bull alone at night, with Rasa. And the thunder was really, and lightning was really scaring Rasa. And she was racing around the room in this frantic state in this barn stall. And I just sat up and held this horse next to me right smack in the middle of this terror that Rasa was feeling. And I protected this foal with my life. And it was absolutely instinctual. And I thought, where did I get that bravery? You know? And I mean, it was just beyond thought. It was something that I had to do. The other thing that was interesting, too, is this idea that this combination of power and bravery and connection and love and this willing to be vulnerable. Because at that moment, all I could do is protect this vulnerable foal. If Rasa had leaped on me or ground me into the ground, I would have had no recourse. But through the act of doing that, she calmed down also. And then as Merlin became connected to his son, we let him be with his son and Rasa over the fence at times. He calmed down, and he suddenly became open to being touched and rubbed. And so it was like this contact high effect that they talk about with oxytocin, where they've done studies to show that a rat that has been injected with oxytocin and then put back into the cage with his little rat buddies, that the other rat buddies become they start to show the effects of oxytocin as well, so that it has this kind of like nobody really knows exactly how it works or exactly how oxytocin is transferred from one being to another, even without touch. They're just starting to explore that, but they can see that oxytocin can give others in the vicinity of someone a kind of a contact high. So it really has this herd bonding power that seems to be part of its intention. And yet at the same time, as Spirit grew up, because we had nurtured him, now we're dealing with the fact that we have a young stallion that has no fear of humans whatsoever. So you had to really be strong with that horse, you know, because he was now planning to treat you like another horse, you know. And so we had to learn how to do that, and we had to learn how to deal with a horse that had absolutely no fear of humans whatsoever, and how truly brave you have to be and intelligent you have to be in dealing with that. So it just exploded exponentially, having that experience of standing up to that intense stallion, having a mate with my mare, having this wild thing happen where we end up milking her and feeding this boy, and then having to stand up to him as he grows into power with no fear. It was an astonishing experience.
Yeah, and it sounds like because he was so vulnerable, then it kind of made everyone around him, or I'm guessing, fall into this sort of the spell of this oxytocin.
Oh, he was just a little doll. He was like a little doll horse. I mean, you could pick him up and carry him around. And he was just so cute and so engaged and alive and so happy to be alive. And, I mean, it was just like a love fest in there.
But was it him, or was it the fact that, well, obviously it was to do with him as a character, but was it also the fact his sheer vulnerability? And presumably men had the same, he had the same impact on men.
Yeah, he absolutely had the same impact on men. Yeah, you know, I mean, he had this combination of extreme vulnerability. Like, he literally didn't have a leg to stand on. If he stood up, his knees weren't fully formed yet, and his legs would bend backwards. So we had to put him in a sling when he was trying to stand up, and then we had to, like, lay with him when he was out of the sling to keep him from trying to stand up and run around and damage his legs. But at the same time, he had the greatest capacity for just healing people in his presence. And so, you know, often we think a lot of times that to affect change in the world, we have to have our act together, and we have to be perfect, and we have to always come from a position of power and non-vulnerability. And yet Spirit's greatest ability to heal others effortlessly happened in the room when he was at his most vulnerable. So he really showed us the power of vulnerability in this extremely graphic way. And he wasn't embarrassed about his vulnerability. He was having a grand old time. I mean, he would watch David Letterman with us. You know, to this day, that horse has more focus than the average horse because of all the ways that he had to sit still and focus. He exercised his ability to focus more than the average horse would. So, it was quite an experience.
I was going to ask how that transformed into the mature horse that he is now. How all of that experience?
Well, he has his own mare now, and he has his own daughter, and they all live together. He's now been gelded because I didn't want to have – I need to, like, stop having family members at some point here. But we allowed him to grow up, and we have a beautiful Mustang mare, actually, that he mated with. And teaching him how to mate and respect his own mare was very interesting, too, because he had such a sense of bravery and entitlement, you know, that he scared her so badly. They were just even over the fence from each other that she didn't go into heat for 3 months, you know. You know when you see a scene on a sidewalk where a woman's walking by and there's a bunch of construction workers and they're all going woo-woo and whistling and all of that? This spirit approached his mate as if the construction workers dropped all their tools and just started running after the woman, you know? I mean, it was way over the top. And so we had to teach him how to respect his mare's boundaries and how to relax and invite her to come to him. And when he successfully was able to do that, she went into heat and they were able to mate. So it was a very interesting adventure.
Indeed, indeed. Kristen makes a note that you're just talking about how you were bottle feeding him, and she says, "Funny that humans have such a negative reaction to women breastfeeding in this culture. Is that true? Is it sort of frowned upon in the States?"
Not so much in the States anymore. I mean, that was certainly the case when I was growing up in the 1960s, but now you see women breastfeeding on planes or in parks or whatever, and nobody really gives it a second thought, at least that I can tell.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't really think I see it that much. I remember seeing it a couple of times, but yeah, I guess men are just curious.
Well, usually they're pretty subtle about it. They usually have a blanket over the child or something.
No, the less subtle, the better, for as far as I'm concerned.
Right, exactly.
Anyway, I think that's a suitably inappropriate note to finish on.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, sorry about that, folks, you know.
Well, I just think that's part of the reason why you might find very well-defined roles for men and women in tribal cultures. I think because there's just not a whole lot of space or privacy, so that you tend to find well-defined roles for men and women so that there feels like there is some kind of boundary when there is no actual privacy. You're in tents, you're living together with your kids and your husband in your tent or your wife. The tents are close to each other. I mean, there's no privacy. So I think that's where that defined role comes in.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And are you intending to pursue your study of the Fulani tribe and see if you can find a little bit more about the women?
Yeah, I think over time I will. But, you know, for now, I think for our purposes, it's not like I'm trying to recommend that people become like the Fulani in all aspects. What I'm saying is let's look at all different cultures, and as you'll see in the next couple of chapters, let's look at a number of different religions that have a non-predatory perspective, and let's draw out those pieces that people have discovered that we could make a productive part of modern life as we all move forward together. So I think, you know, I've spent a good amount of time with the Fulani and I learned a lot from them. And what I want to do now is start to engage these kinds of tools and make them appropriate for modern life.
Right. Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's a means to an end, obviously, the research you've done to produce the book and to educate us and help us. So thank you. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening in and your questions and so forth. And if you're listening to this on the replay, hope you enjoy it. And if you do have further comments, then you can place those on the chapter page. And I know Linda's been replying to those recently. And,
yes, I'm actually checking that more often and actually replying now because I'm not writing anymore. So
right.
Feel free to make comments and or ask questions, and I'm at least checking in twice a week on it. So
good, great, thank you. Did you see, just by the by, because I'm going to have to, when I cut off, we can't continue to talk. Did you see my email over the weekend about some of the changes I was going to be making?
Yes, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about it, for sure.
Yeah. So I'll exchange emails with you about that. Maybe we can just have a quick chat at some point this week just to catch up on it.
Yes, I will have time.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, thanks, everyone. And, of course, thank you, Linda. And everyone will be pleased to know that Guiding Principle 8 is hot on my arrived in my inbox, hot and ready to go. So I will try and turn that around before the weekend, along with the recording, and give you some more reading and listening to enjoy. So thanks, everyone, and we'll speak with you soon. Bye for now, and take care.
Bye.
Bye.